From the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, this is NIH Research Radio.
Welcome to the 51st episode of NIH Research Radio with news about the ongoing medical research at the National Institutes of Health, the nation's medical research agency. I'm your host, Joe Balintvi, and coming up in this edition, we'll have a report and talk more with Dr. Griffin Rogers about chronic kidney disease, and we'll have an interview with the director of NIH about biomedical imaging. But first, a story about how some brain tumors grow. That's next on NIH Research Radio.
You're listening to the fourth leading cause of death, and it's probably not what you think. It's COPD, a serious lung disease that over time makes it hard to breathe and do the things that are important in your life. Sound like you? Shortness of breath isn't normal at any age, so talk with your doctor about COPD. If you experience shortness of breath or other symptoms, get a simple breathing test. Once you know about COPD, you can take steps to treat it and live a more active life. Learn more. Breathe better. Go to www.learnaboutcopd.org. A message from the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Researchers have uncovered an error in immature brain cells that may promote the growth of some brain tumors. This is according to a study by the National Cancer Institute and the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke. Here's Wally Akinza with a report.
In various laboratory experiments, a breakdown in proper cell development has been shown to cause brain-specific stem cells to become starter seeds for aggressive brain tumors called glioblastoma multiforme. Dr. Howard Fine, chief of the neuro-oncology branch at the NIC's Center of Cancer Research, talks about the clinical context of the findings.
The more we understand the mechanisms by which normal cells become tumor cells and how they depend on these abnormal mechanisms, then we can develop new treatments, specifically new drugs, to target these abnormal pathways. Hopefully, in these particular cases, make these tumor stem cells behave more like normal stem cells and make them mature and differentiate, at which point they would no longer be able to grow and cause tumor growth.
According to Dr. Fine, many researchers have come to believe that the activity of a small group of stem-like tumor starter cells or tumor-initiating cells with stem-like properties may be one of the main reasons that cancer develops. This is Wally Akinso at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
In this next report, though February is American Heart Month, it is also an important time to talk about kidney disease. Dr. Griffin Rogers, director of the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases, explains.
We know there's a very important connection between chronic kidney disease, or CKD, and cardiovascular disease. People with CKD are more likely to develop cardiovascular disease than people without CKD.
Dr. Rogers warns that the connection between chronic kidney disease and cardiovascular disease goes both ways.
People with CKD have a higher risk of developing cardiovascular disease. And the reverse is true as well. People with cardiovascular disease have a higher risk of chronic kidney disease. High blood pressure and diabetes damage the small vessels in the kidneys and elsewhere in the body, including the vessels that supply the heart.
Dr. Rogers says it's important to be screened for chronic kidney disease.
CKD is often called a silent disease because many people don't realize that they have chronic kidney disease until their kidneys have almost completely stopped working. The NIH recommends that people who have diabetes, high blood pressure, and cardiovascular disease or family history of cardiovascular disease work with their health care provider to monitor their kidney health. blood and urine tests are the only ways to know if early CKD is present.
Dr. Rogers adds that people with CKD can take important steps to keep their kidneys, heart, and blood vessels healthier longer.
These steps are, for example, maintaining their blood pressure at 130 over 80 or below. And an important way of doing this is to limit the sodium intake. Some drugs not only lower the blood pressure, but they can also protect the kidneys and the heart. If diabetes is present, for example, controlling the blood sugar is a way to not only maintain the integrity and viability of the kidneys, but also of the heart and blood vessels. Maintaining a healthy body weight, maintaining a healthy lifestyle with exercise, quit smoking, and controlling the cholesterol. And although aspirin is quite effective in reducing the risk of cardiovascular disease, in patients that have CKD, there is an increased risk of them developing abnormal bleeding complications. So it's very important for one to check with one's healthcare provider before taking aspirin in this context.
Up next, more discussion with Dr. Griffin Rogers about the risks and connection between chronic kidney disease and cardiovascular disease.
Many calls. Many clicks. And yet, just one call to 1-888-693-NDEP or one click to www.yourdiabetesinfo.org gets you the free diabetes information you need. The National Diabetes Education Program makes it easier than ever. Get free information on living with diabetes, tips to prevent or delay type 2 diabetes, and how to help loved ones manage the disease. Just one call to 1-888-693-NDEP. Just one click to www.yourdiabetesinfo.org. One call, one click. The National Diabetes Education Program, your source for free diabetes information. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
We're talking with Dr. Griffin Rogers, director of the National Institute on Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases. Can you give us some more background on chronic kidney disease?
Mm-hmm. Well, most people have two kidneys, and they're located in the middle of the back, just below the rib cages on either side of the spine. Now, every day, the healthy kidney filters about 200 quarts of blood, and from that, it removes about 2 quarts of waste and extra water in the form of urine. Now, the kidneys really play a significant role in not only the elimination of this waste, but in also controlling the blood pressure, in making red blood cells, and maintaining healthy bones. Each kidney contains roughly a million tiny filters made up of blood vessels. And kidney disease or chronic kidney disease occurs when these blood vessels become damaged. Over time, more and more of these vessels and filters become damaged, and eventually the kidney loses its filtering capabilities. When it does that, one has to either undergo dialysis, which is an artificial form of filtering the blood, or at that stage require a kidney transplantation to retain the filtering ability of the kidneys. Now, the most common cause of chronic kidney disease, or CKD in this country, are diabetes and high blood pressure. And so that people with these conditions should be regularly tested for the presence of chronic kidney disease. And the earlier one determines whether one has CKD or not, then steps can be taken to reduce the risk of further kidney damage.
So is the increased risk of cardiovascular disease due to the kidney disease or to the conditions that lead to, say, CKD, specifically diabetes and high blood pressure?
Well, we're still learning more about the interactions of these diseases, but no doubt CKD is an important risk factor, an important independent risk factor for developing cardiovascular disease. Traditional heart risk factors such as hypertension, smoking, diabetes, or older age are very common among people with CKD. In fact, nearly all the people with CKD have high blood pressure, a known risk factor for the development and progression of cardiovascular disease. For many patients, the earliest sign of CKD is protein in the urine. It is also a predictor of cardiovascular disease. And people with CKD are also more likely to have a metabolic syndrome, which is a constellation of symptoms, obesity, blood sugar, poor control, high blood pressure, some of the cardiovascular symptoms as well.
Does high blood pressure lead to chronic kidney disease or vice versa? Is that an oversimplification?
No, you hit the nail right on the head. What happens is that the kidney is filtering this blood. Now, as you, the high blood pressure, which is sort of pushing through these filters, ultimately can damage those filters. And as you lose one and then two and then multiple of these filters, you're not allowing the blood to be filtered at all. And thus, the hypertension remains present, but one now begins to increase the levels of toxins in the blood, increases the amount of sodium that's retained in the blood, and those all contribute to further increase the blood pressure, and subsequently further damaging those few remaining filters that are in the kidney. So one leads to the other, but having the presence of the other can kind of start a spiraling effect. The same is true with diabetes.
So what are some of the things that NIH is doing to explore the connection between CKD and CVD?
Mm-hmm. Many researchers funded by the NIH at university and academic and medical centers throughout the United States are working on CKD and cardiovascular disease and their connection. For example, the National Institute of Diabetes, Digestive, and Kidney Diseases is sponsoring a major study, the Chronic Renal Insufficiency Cohort, or CRIC study. Is a study to identify factors linked with a rapid decline in kidney function and the development of cardiovascular disease. CRIC is following 3,000 adults for 7 years, and all study participants have mild or moderate chronic kidney disease, or CKD, as an important entry criteria. We believe that a subset of these patients will go on to lose their kidney function more rapidly than others and develop cardiovascular disease more rapidly than others. We're also partnering with the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute on a study of systolic blood pressure intervention, or the SPRINT study. I mentioned previously that we recommend that patients that have chronic kidney disease maintain their blood pressure at a level of 130 over 80. But in this group, in this study that we're performing in collaboration with the Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, we're really going to target a lower number, 120 or lower, to see whether we lower it by that amount, one can diminish the decline in loss of kidney function as a function of time.
Terrific. Are there other NIDDK research avenues that are addressing CKD in connection with cardiovascular disease?
Well, you know, there's a rise in this country in obesity, and that's contributing not only to diabetes and hypertension, but also cardiovascular disease and chronic kidney disease, or CKD. We need to learn about this relationship between these conditions, how they affect each other, and how we can prevent and treat them. At NIDDK, we're also investing in a broad range of studies from both basic biology to clinical trials about diabetes, obesity, and CKD. And we're also committed to rapidly translating this new knowledge into proven therapies that benefit patients. We have a National Kidney Disease Education Program, or NKDEP, is educating the public, health professionals, and laboratory professionals on the best ways to prevent, detect, and to treat CKD and frank kidney failure. And we're working, for example, with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to reduce the morbidity and mortality associated with diabetes through the parent of the NKDEP is the National Diabetes Education Program. We're also partnering with other institutes at the NIH, in particular the Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, the National Cancer Institute, or NCI, and the National Institute of Child Health, to address the nationwide childhood obesity epidemic through the We Can program. We Can is an acronym that stands for Ways to Enhance Children's Activity and Nutrition. And so we believe that if we intercede or interject very early on in this process of obesity leading to diabetes and high blood pressure, and that ultimately leading to chronic kidney disease, that early prevention is really the best way to go here.
For more information about CKD, visit the National Kidney Disease Education's website at www.nkdep.nih.gov or call toll-free 1-866-4-KIDNEY. For this next interview, I'm pleased to have Dr. Elias Zerhoni, Director of the National Institutes of Health. A leader in the field of biomedical imaging, we talked about the importance of CAT scans, MRIs, and the science of imaging in general. Dr. Zerhoni, what do you think is the most important information the American public should understand about biomedical imaging today?
I think that imaging is really a science that has come into its own. Not only over the past 30 years, but it's currently undergoing a tremendous revolution. The reason is it's addressing a very fundamental need in medicine. In the past, to find out what was going on in the body, you had to do surgery. So in many ways, the dream of scientists in imaging like myself was to, how can you peek into the human body without destroying it? So it's non-destructive. And that was the impetus for my research in CAT scanning and MRI over the past 30 years, and has made a revolution in how we diagnose disease and how we treat disease. But going forward, what people are realizing is that in biology, interactions, whether it be a DNA, an RNA, a molecule with another one, a cell within a cell, or an organelle within a cell, a cell with a cell, or within tissues, all of these interactions are localized in space. And to extract that information, you need what we call imaging. So imaging is going to work over the next 40 years to try to unravel the mysteries of how molecules interact, how cells interact, how tissues interact. And it is going to be even more important, not just for medical applications, for fundamental research, and for understanding biology.
What is your view about the value of CT scanning, specifically in detecting certain cancers?
So basically, when you look at an imaging technique, essentially what you have is a way of looking at biology, looking at anatomy and structure and function in an indirect way. And whenever you have an indirect technique, what you really want to know is how accurate it is. And you don't want too many false negatives where you're missing something, or false positive when you're seeing something that you think is a disease. And that's why CAT scanning has been developed to detect lesions in organs like the lung or the rest of the body. And we are developing other tests like ultrasound, for example, to look at intrauterine pregnancy and so on. So the value has increased over time, mammography to look at early cancers. But every time you do this, you have to be very careful, because the value of a test depends on how accurate it is. And to find that out, you need to really do very rigorous trials. It's not enough to believe that something works. You have to prove that it works. So that's what I think is important here, is we have to do that research to provide the American public with a very, very scientific, evidence-based answer rather than opinion-based answer.
Dr. Zerhoni, what do you see as the long-term opportunities and benefits of this new era in biomedical imaging?
Well, to me, the new era is because we are in need of understanding at all scales, from angstrom, you know, at the molecular level, to atoms, to molecules, to cells, to tissues, exactly how the complex biological interactions that make health or disease really work. And imaging is fundamentally a tool to extract biological information or do something about that at all scales. So would it be in electron microscopy or CAT scanning or mouse imaging or human imaging, all of that has one fundamental a common thread. And that is that now biologists know that to understand biology, you really need to know what happens in situ, in vivo, and hopefully without you destroying the system, but by understanding how it really works.
How do you think the NIH is prepared to take advantage of this new biomedical imaging era?
I think we've seen an explosion, actually, in new ideas, new technologies. For example, one of the fields that has advanced a lot right now is the idea that you could combine a molecule that sends a light, fluorescent molecule, with imaging that doesn't rely on X-rays like CAT scanning or radio waves like MRI, but relies on optical imaging. So now you have the combination of digital optical imaging, like the cameras you have to take pictures, in the laboratory with a probe that is brought into the tissue or the cell to highlight one molecule. So one example, NIH and its researchers, Dr. Jennifer Lippincott-Schwartz and her colleagues, came up with a technique called photoactivated light microscopy. What it is that Dr. Lippincott-Schwartz and her colleagues can identify a specific molecule. Why? Because they can actually tag the molecule with another molecule that emits light. So as that light comes out, it's picked up by the microscope, but it's not. It's controlled. In other words, they can themselves trigger the light. So that means that you can wait, and then when something happens, you can trigger the light, say, where did it happen in the cell? How did it happen? And that, I think, is going to be an enormous revolution in the way we understand biology, health, in health and disease.
For more information about the NIH director, Dr. Elias Zerhoni, visit www.nih.gov/about/director. This interview also appears in the NIH vodcast, Eye on NIH, and is published in Medline Plus magazine. To see that publication of the National Library of Medicine, visit their website at www.nlm.nih.gov. And that's it for this episode of NIH Research Radio. Please join us again on Friday, February 22nd, when the next edition of NIH Research Radio will be available for download. I'm your host, Joe Belinfi. Thanks for tuning in. NIH Research Radio is a presentation of the NIH Radio News Service, part of the News Media Branch, Office of Communications and Public Liaison, in the Office of the Director at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, an agency of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.